Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at MormonStories.org.
I'm John DeLynn, and I'm honored to be here with D. Michael Quinn and many distinguished guests. It's August 12th, 2011, and we are here at a private dinner on a day where we're honoring the many great works and contributions of D. Michael Quinn in Mormon history and in Mormonism in general. And we just had a lovely meal, and we're ready to jump in with questions. And so we've asked our guests to come up with some questions. We have Ann Pepper running the mic. And so we would like to open up the floor to our first questioner for Michael Quinn. We are going, go ahead and raise your hand when you're ready, and I'll fill the silence. We've asked our audience to focus their questions right now on more historical issues and other types of issues around dates and facts and information and insight and opinion. We'll be focusing the actual conference and the interview, the Mormon Stories interview, more on Michael's own personal story and his own personal journey, because that's what Mormon Stories is all about. And I should mention that all this is brought to you by the Mormon Stories Podcast, the Open Stories Foundation, and Sunstone's helped out a little bit as well. So let's have our first question from Trevor.
This question, I guess, through all the research that you've done, could you think of maybe one single thing that you discovered, one surprise, for good or for bad, that was just, maybe the most interesting, unexpected thing that you were that you encountered in all your research?
All right. Well, it was, I can remember the day very clearly. I went down to the basement of 47 East South Temple, which is a squarish kind of Doric. I think it is Doric building that houses the general authorities. And at the time, I was a new employee of Leonard Arrington as a research assistant, and I was also a graduate student at the U. And I had found references in the old catalogs of the church historian's office, references to documents that they couldn't find in the church historian's office. So somebody said, well, go down and talk with Lars Peterson, who was one of the old guard, which is what we called them, and they kind of embraced the term themselves, of employees hired by and trained by Joseph Fielding Smith when he was the church historian. And so I went down there and asked if he knew where these documents might be, and we had a discussion about what he thought of Leonard Arrington and me and the new directions that things were going. And then I said, well, can I go over and look at those documents or in that area where those you say those documents might be? And he said, sure. So I went over, and it was a dimly lit place, and it was in the recesses of the basement, and I rounded a corner, and there I was just drop-jawed, bug-eyed, because stacked on the floor, anywhere from 3 feet to 5 feet tall, were just mounds of documents. And I started going through them. This was about 12:30, I think. And I emerged from my days of research and discovery about 7 hours later. And among the documents I found, there were account books of Brigham Young, the books of the giving the weight of gold that the gold missionaries had brought back from their secret mission to California to join in the gold rush and bring the gold back for the church. I found two file cabinets of B.H. Roberts' correspondence, as well as his documents on looking at the Book of Mormon in a non-traditional way. And I found minutes of the first presidency. It was an unbelievable kind of Christmas morning for me. And during that time, every morning was Christmas morning. But this was like on speed, or it was just unbelievable, the experience. I didn't tell Leonard about this because I left so late after the last time, that I told him the next day about this discovery. And he immediately had the informed the archivist. Leonard was not in charge of the archives. He was in charge of the research and writing division of the historical department, as it was called then. And so he informed the church archivist, who was then Earl Olson, and employees came down and began putting these documents that I had discovered in boxes. And Leonard later told me that what I had discovered filled 80 cartons. So it was quite an amazing discovery. And that, I would, without question, say that with no competitor, was my major experience with discovering something that thrilled me and floored me and inspired me.
First of all, I'm excited to hear Earl Olson's name. I'm his niece.
Oh.
He passed away a few months ago, actually. My question has to do with polygamy era. In the church today, when we teach about the priesthood, we don't teach that worthiness is necessarily connected to different levels of the priesthood, just simply different keys and responsibilities. But when I've read accounts and stories of Joseph Smith entering into polygamy and encouraging women to marry him and families being encouraged to give their daughters in polygamous marriages, it's oftentimes cited a greater ability to gain salvation if one is sealed to a higher priesthood. And then, of course, when the saints came to Utah, there are records and stories of young men and young women being sealed to different apostles as sons, as a greater means by which to achieve salvation. So I'm wondering if there was a historical shift in teaching that higher priesthoods maybe were destined to higher, greater chance of salvation, or if that's doctrinally based, or if that was just something that Joseph Smith and some of our early leaders just were kind of exploring.
Well, if you're trying to distinguish Mormon doctrine from what Joseph Smith and Brigham Young taught, that's a problem, because they defined what they said as Mormon doctrine. Brigham Young, in fact, said that once his sermons were published, that they were scripture. So, pardon me, my voice goes in and out. So, you really can't, in their minds, there was no distinction between Mormon doctrine and what they were teaching in the name of the Lord. Brigham Young was very specific that a man who had higher priesthood was entitled to women that and a man with, say, an elder was not, and that there was a very clear distinction that he made over the pulpit, that there was a priority of who women should be want to be sealed to, and that he claimed that his teachings on polygamy all came from Joseph Smith. So even where we're not able to identify Joseph Smith as saying that to a particular woman or a particular man, most of Brigham Young's teachings, he claimed, he got directly from Joseph Smith. The only distinction, or the only exception to that, I think, is his views on race, because he reversed Joseph Smith's views about race and African Americans and slavery. But with that exception, I think we can pretty well accept that when Brigham Young said he was teaching what he was taught, that that's what he believed. And that seems to have been the teaching that Joseph Smith gave him, that there is, in fact, a priority. A man with a higher priesthood office is entitled to more wives than somebody who is not, and that women should therefore aspire to be the wives of men with higher priesthood, which brings up a funny little incident. Spencer Kimball tells this story that when he was president of the church, he would regale people with stories about Heber C. Kimball, his grandfather. And it's amazing that somebody this close to our time was only removed two generations from that Joseph Smith period. But Spencer W. Kimball had that connection. And even though Heber C. Kimball had about 40 wives, he was not an enthusiastic polygamist. And the story that Spencer Kimball told is that one day Heber looked out the window here in Salt Lake of his home and saw two women coming down the path from the gate, front gate to his front door. And he went and hid in the closet and told his wife to tell them that he wasn't there. He didn't want to have another wife. But this message had clearly been given to the people at large and to women at large. And there were young women in their 20s, even in their teen years, who expressed in their diaries and in conversations with one another that they did not want to marry an unseasoned elder. They wanted to marry someone who'd been proven through the trials of church membership and years of service, and that was the kind of husband they wanted, and if they didn't mind sharing such a man with his other wives.
Mike, actually, I hate to say my own, tell a story out of that, but it arises from what you just said. In doing some research on one of my genealogy lines, I realized how important family ties were in those days. And in one instance, a young girl in her teens was engaged to be married to a young man in his 20s, and a terrible thing happened just before the marriage, and he died. And so she was married to his father because of the importance of that family tie, and ended up bearing him 13 children. So it happens. My question was kind of a follow-up to your first comment on finding that treasure trove of documents. How exciting. And my question is, was this part of the first presidency vault? And if it wasn't, do you have a sense that any of those documents may have migrated back into that vault? And have you ever seen the documents that are in that vault?
Well, there is more than one first presidency vault. At one point, Brigham Young was the one who began putting documents in a vault. And this was for fire. I mean, fires were common. And it was for protective purposes, not really secretive purposes. Then when there were provided specific offices for the first presidency aside from Brigham Young's own home, then they had a vault to protect those documents, such as the minutes of the first presidency. By the time they moved into the building, the squarish building at 47 East South Temple, they built a walk-in vault, a vault. I've been in it, and my memory is that it was about the size of from that wall to that wall, and maybe from the lights here to this wall. That I think that was approximately the size of it, and it was entered only through the first presidency's office. And in that vault, there were documents originating with the first presidency, such as their minutes and the minutes of their meetings with the 12, Quorum of the 12 Apostles. Then there were specially guarded documents that also were put into that location, minutes of the Council of 50, which were minutes of a theocratic organization Joseph Smith established shortly before he died. Those minutes from 1844 to its last meeting in 1884 were kept in the, and still are, kept in the First Presidency's vault. But Joseph Fielding Smith, as an apostle, was appointed church historian in 1920, and he had a vault on wheels, typical of the bank vaults of that time period, which were on wheels. And he had that in his office, and any time he came across a document he thought was very sensational or very sensitive, he would put it in that file, in that movable roller wheel kind of safe. Well, when he became president, he'd been president of the church in January 1970. He had been church historian for 50 years and had been squirreling away documents without keeping any record of them in this vault. He had no idea what was in it, just that there were things in it, some of which he may have remembered. And so when he moved physically his office to the office of the First Presidency, he had them wheel this movable vault into the walk-in vault of the First Presidency. So there was a portable vault within a vault, and the secretary to the First Presidency was responsible for it but didn't have the combination. And after Joseph Fielding Smith died, the secretary, in frustration, called down to the historical department and said that he was frustrated that he was responsible as part of his calling for this vault, but had no idea what was in it. And so at that point, it was just a few months after Joseph Fielding Smith died, there were three people, you know, who went inside the walk-in vault, and one of them had the combination to the little vault, and they opened it up, and they did, for the very first time in 50 years, an inventory of what was in it. And I didn't see that inventory, but I know from other references, some correspondence of what was in the First Presidency's vault long before Joseph Fielding brought in his own. In addition to the Council of 50 Minutes, it has artifacts. It has the brown seer stone that Joseph Smith used for the Book of Mormon. It has his whitish-colored seer stone, milky-colored seer stone that he used for the Book of Abraham translation. It has the journal of George Q. Cannon, the journal of Francis M. Lyman, both of whom kept very revealing journals, partly for self-defense in case they were accused of doing something that they didn't do or saying something that they didn't say. They wrote everything. So that they could say where they were, what they said, and what they heard, what they contributed to. And so because those were so revealing of the inner workings of the First Presidency, and with Francis M. Lyman, he was the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, the decision was made not to allow family members to have those, but to keep them once family members made the mistake of bringing it for the First Presidency. They disappeared. And very few family members were allowed to see them again. Beyond those items that I've mentioned, I really do not know what else was in the old walk-in vault of the First Presidency. And I know virtually nothing about what was in Joseph Fielding Smith's vault, except he had his grandfather's temple garments in there. So he had the temple garments of Hiram Smith. But that's the only item that I know that he had, and that included the leaf apron from the temple ceremony that Hiram Smith had worn in Nauvoo. And the only reason I know that is that it was on the probate inventory of Joseph Fielding Smith's estate, and those things were included in his vault items. No, in fact, they had all taken them off, and it was because of the intense heat in June. The only one who kept his on was Willard Richards, and he was the only one who wasn't seriously injured or killed. There are other vaults, and sometimes they're called the church vault. And there's a vault of the Quorum of the Twelve.
There's a vault of the 70. There's a Salt Lake Temple vault. There's a law department vault. You name it. If they had documents that they thought were very important, even though they might be a subordinate kind of bureaucratic organization, they had a vault, very often a walk-in vault. And I've been in the vaults of the law department at one point when it was located in a building where it's not located now. I've been in the Salt Lake Temple vault, as well as the First Presidency's vault and the Historical Department's vault. But being in there and seeing what's in there, two different things. And I was allowed in, but was not allowed to browse.
Well, just a quick follow-up. Wait. There are documents, are there not, that you have seen and actually transcribed, but that historians today probably wouldn't.
That's correct.
Can you repeat the question?
The question is that I have examined and transcribed, some cases verbatim, documents that are now unavailable to historians. That's true, but those transcriptions are available in the Beinecke Library of Yale University. All my research notes from that time period I transferred to Yale when I moved to Mexico and wasn't sure I was going to survive the adventure down there, and I didn't want them to end up like B.H. Roberts' stuff ended up in the basement of a church. So they are open to the public, unlike my personal papers at Yale. Those are not. But the research files, including all those transcriptions, they are there. That includes minutes of the First Presidency, minutes of the Quorum of the 12, minutes of the Council of 50, and lesser minutes.
Yes, I now have about 15 questions based on this dialogue, but I'll just go with one. You know, over the course of time, as I've read pieces of your research, pieces of other scholars' research, you know, I found it somewhat liberating to see that the way the church has instituted policies and programs today, which many of us have interpreted as very rigid and somewhat in the box, but to see church history and how it played out, that it was very free-flowing, things that we think are steadfast rules today weren't so much, you know, that strongly applied back in the early days of the church. Everything from women giving priesthood blessings to what you said about the garments, they weren't as, you know, wear them every day and night. And so a lot of people have found that insight to be somewhat liberating, in the sense that the rigidity we experience today wasn't always the case. So as you look forward and see that the church is taking, albeit tiny baby steps, to put out more information on the true nature of how the church came about, its origins, do you foresee that as a move on the church's part to kind of, you know, put it out there, and perhaps there's a benefit they see in that same line of thinking, that perhaps it will be empowering to members as opposed to, you know, a tidal wave of crisis of faith once people learn details that many of us around these tables are already aware of? I mean, what do you foresee as being the benefit the church sees in slowly but surely putting out tiny slivers of information that you initially got into?
Essentially, there was a 30-year lag between Leonard Arrington and the openness that he promoted as a historian, although he was not the archivist. The one who opened the church archives was Howard W. Hunter. In 1970, 2 years before Leonard was appointed as church historian. Howard W. Hunter, as successor to Joseph Fielding Smith, wanted to meet with professional historians and get their suggestions, and because of those meetings, he opened the archives. And so when I came straight out of the Army as this wide-eyed graduate student at the University of Utah, and was in the what was then the church historian's office, Leonard Arrington, like me, was just a researcher. I mean, he was a powerhouse of a historian, had published with Harvard, and had, even at that time, I think something on the order of a dozen books and scores of articles. But we were on the same footing in the sense that he had no official position with the historical, or rather the historian's office in 1971 when I met Leonard Arrington. He was a researcher, he had research assistants, and I was a research assistant, as well as doing research for my own work as a graduate student. The openness that he advocated ended in early 1980s, and it, I think you can date its resurrection with the Joseph Smith Papers Project. And between those two events, the closing, so to speak, or the limiting to a very high degree of access in the church archives, to that dramatic announcement of those papers, the single factor that made that announcement possible and led the leadership to choose for greater openness is the internet. It's impossible, and they soon found at church headquarters, you could not protect teenagers from these controversies because all they had to do was plug in Word of Wisdom, Mormonism, and they would come up with typically sensationalized material provided by Protestant evangelicals as a part of their effort to use history as a battering ram against anyone's faith in Mormonism. And I think that because the internet is uncontrollable, there's no way to keep teenagers from and even parental controls wouldn't control that, because those are geared toward controlling other things. They're not geared, unless the church comes out with its own that it'll sell through Deseret Book. It's not geared to filter out controversies in Mormonism. Now, I may have given them an idea. I don't know. But so I think that the internet has made the leadership reconsider the kind of philosophy that Leonard Arrington and many of us in his footsteps were promoting 30 years ago, that the church has nothing to lose, really, and very much to gain by giving even teenagers some grasp of the diversity, the controversies in our past. And that openness I see moving ahead. I think because of the internet, it won't reverse. Just because if it did reverse, everyone who had access to the internet would know it. There are no longer these little secrets that are maintained at church headquarters. The internet has made this available in a dramatic way, and I think it's a great blessing. The church certainly uses it for promoting its public image, but it also has had to, as a institution, confront the reality that they can't control information anymore, and that anyone who wants to can, with a very simple few terms and a Google search, come up with the worst kind of diatribes that could be imagined against the church. And so the best defense, I think, is an honest offense, which is the way they seem to be going.
So with the church then having to confront that, do you foresee them being forced to reconsider the nature of correlation as we know it today and knew it through the 80s and 90s?
You don't use forced with regard to 47 East South Temple. They don't acknowledge that word. I think that it's inevitable that there are going to be some changes with regard to correlation. But in the 1970s, I thought that was inevitable after only 8 years of correlation. So historians aren't very good as prophets. But I do think that there are going to come changes. The diversity of Mormonism, I think, demands less rigid control at church headquarters over teaching instruction in multiple cultures, multiple languages. Certainly, because the church is a hierarchy, there will be control. There will be oversight. There will be direction. But I think that the internet, again, has contributed to this. I think that the correlation will not be as tight-fisted as it was in the first 30 years of its history.
My question is similar to the previous question. I was going to ask that many historians have said that we need to scrap correlation and teach the accurate history and an effect of stunting, all the disaffection. You pretty much started to answer it, but is it even possible in the way that we would all like? The way I see it is, if the church just laid it out there in Sunday school, people's heads would explode. So how can it be done, and should it be done?
In Correlation's defense, the church, it's not a threat, but it's a challenge. The church, ever since the 1960s, has faced a fundamental challenge of centrifugal growth. And with that massive growth in the hinterlands of the church, in particular in different cultures where English is not the common language, it was a question of losing the identity of Mormonism, that it might become what the Irish Church was to Catholicism in Rome, what the French Church was to Catholicism in Rome, national churches with their own way of doing Catholicism. And sometimes in opposition to the Holy See in Rome. Well, the leadership of the church didn't want to relive that experience, and that's a major reason why Correlation came into effect, was to standardize the manuals, the instruction. And I've often said that, and this is unfair, but I've said it, that this is to make the general authorities feel at home no matter where they are in the world. But it's also to make sure that Mormonism is the same, and that you don't get a Mexican version of Mormonism, which happened in Mexico in the 1940s. And they don't have living memories because most of them were too young. But some of the much older men do remember that. They remember that what was called the Third Convention in Mexico, where they built their own chapels, they gave their own lessons, they ran a parallel and rival church called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Third Convention. So Correlation is one defense against that happening. And for that reason, I don't think they will ever give up the idea and philosophy and the engine of Correlation. But I'm hoping that it will be more adaptable to the differences that are inevitable in the multicultures that the church enters. And I don't know. It may not, because there are many people in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, who are very happy to be Americanized. And they're very happy to become a part of an American religion. Other, I think, a vastly larger population in those areas do not want to be Americanized, and resist the American trappings that are often attached by missionaries to the gospel and by mission presidents. That's a tension, and I expect that that's going to remain a tension. My hope is that Correlation will loosen its grip. But like I say, historians are terrible as prophets.
Well, I hate to change topics. I would like to stick to Correlation. I think this is a good topic we could probably discuss for the rest of the time here. My question is, I've heard a rumor, and you can confirm or deny it or not even discuss this, that you're writing a book about church finances. Wondering if you might, and if you're comfortable, discuss a little bit about that book.
Very little. I'm writing what I call a third volume of my Mormon hierarchy series, and I keep changing the direction that I'm going. And my last decision was that, a major decision was that I would cover the period of business and finance from 1830 to 2010. And that all obviously leaves me a lot of holes to fill in terms of data and evidence. And so I'm in the process of doing that research. And inshallah, as the Muslims say, I will get it done. But if not, then I won't. But that is my goal, to finish that. But I don't have any details to share with you.
Follow-up question, quick. Time frames? Do you have any time frames on potential when it might be done?
Well, my goal is January. But as I've never met a deadline I didn't break, so I can't promise. And I've been notorious with publishers for promising something at a particular time and being months, years beyond.
One more question. I was recently doing some reading on Brigham Young and the early days of the church in Utah. And you made a comment earlier about, you know, he used to believe or used to say that whatever he said over the pulpit was scripture. Historically, have you ever, do you apply a rule to determine what is, quote, over the pulpit and what is just casual conversation? Because he's not always over the pulpit necessarily, but there's diaries, there's all sorts of sources. How do you straddle that?
Well, as a historian, I've been interested in any little tidbit I could find that was new to me. And so when I was taking detailed notes on diaries of the general authorities starting in 1971, when I was hired as a research assistant to do that, anything I found that was interesting, sensational, new to me, I wanted to record. And so that was the approach that I continued throughout my research career. And I would just write down anything that I found of interest. With Brigham Young's sermons, I found him making off-the-cuff comments to his secretaries in what was recorded as Brigham Young's office journal. Similar offhanded remarks he would make and that were recorded in what was called the historian's office journal. And then, of course, his sermons, which he admitted over the pulpit were censored before they went to press. And he said one of the occasions he said that Albert Carrington cleaned up his language, and Albert Carrington was his secretary for a period of time, and then became an apostle. And what language Brother Carrington cleaned up, you know, is anyone's guess. But Brigham Young, even in the versions that we have in print that he had approved, frequently engaged in frontier humor. I mean, it's very obvious that the kind of humor we connect with Mark Twain was often going on over the pulpit in the tabernacle. And sometimes they would indicate applause or indicate laughter in the minutes that they published. But there was a lot of that going on, and exaggeration is a part of frontier humor. So whether somebody got carried away in the mood, Brigham Young included, and went beyond what Joseph Smith might have told him in the private councils of Nauvoo is anyone's guess. All we know is that Brigham claimed that everything he taught, he had been originally taught in some way by Joseph Smith. And he also claimed that when his sermons were published, they were scripture. And you can't get around that. That was his self-confidence, his claim as a president of the church, and those who are uncomfortable with the things he said have to deal with the confidence with which he said them.
Next question. 1972, Leonard Arrington enters as church historian. Everybody has really high hopes for what will come. 10 years later, his picture's taken off the wall. It ends much different than the way that we all hoped it would end. Can you tell us about what major events or revelations that he provided to us as a public that the brethren weren't necessarily fond of? What led to that downfall?
It was right from the beginning a series of miscommunications and partial communications. And what happened typically was that the first presidency, and at that time, the president of the church was Joseph Fielding Smith in the last few months. His very vigorous counselor was Harold B. Lee, and who did not have not that they were unfriendly, but he didn't have a close relationship with Leonard Arrington as newly appointed church historian. Although he told Leonard personally that he wanted a professional historian in this position. But the one that Leonard, to me at least, most often talked about was N. Eldon Tanner, who was very supportive of the openness of the historical department that Leonard understood the first presidency wanted. But right from the very beginning, when I say the beginning, right after the move of the physical holdings of the church historian's office into the new office building, the east wing at that time of the church office building, right after that, Leonard obtained permission from the first presidency to have an open house and to organize a group of supporters of the new history department. All of this was approved by the first presidency. It was to be called and was called the Friends of Mormon History. And so he had this opening tour. The people went through. They even walked through the vault of the historical department. And in that vault, Earl Olson, who was the archivist, was welcoming them and, you know, greeting them as they came in and kind of just looked around what was in there. The problem was that apparently, and Leonard had no role of informing the 12, but apparently the first presidency had not informed the Quorum of the 12 that it had approved these. And as soon as word got out from those who were in attendance and began talking about what they saw as they were in the first presidency's, or not, excuse me, in the historical department's walk-in vault, members of the Quorum of the 12 went ballistic that there was this, in their terms, violation of security, allowing people to just willy-nilly walk into the vault, even though the church archivist was there. He wasn't the one who got in trouble. It was Leonard who got in trouble. And repeatedly, from that point forward, Leonard would get permission and authorization of the first presidency to do something, and apparently all I can understand or believe is that they kept their own counsel and that they authorized him to do things and never informed the 12, and then the 12 felt blindsided and blamed Leonard, because you don't blame the first presidency when you're in the 12. And so the only one to blame is down the road. And it's easier to blame a functionary, which is how they regarded Leonard. And so Leonard was in continually putting out fires of unhappiness, of disrespect, of criticism from members of the 12 who I can understand why they felt blindsided by each of these developments that they had not been informed of until they learned sometimes from the church news that Leonard was promoting. And they blamed him for being a loose cannon when he was only following very literally what he had been authorized by the first presidency to do. And so it was a Greek tragedy almost from the beginning of the move in November 1972 into the new building. That's my memory. That's where it began.
Were there any specific points of history?
Well, yes. When the first major publishing achievement of the historical department came out, the story of the Latter-day Saints, Ezra Taft Benson got copies or references to it from a devotee in the John Birch Society that he had spying on the historical department, Thomas Truett. And so Tom was feeding him every criticism that he could about what Leonard was doing, and he went through the story of the Latter-day Saints and in a system that became very familiar to some of us, would highlight or underline the things that he found objectionable and show them to Ezra Taft Benson. And Ezra Taft Benson was not trained in history, was not really that interested in history. And so the approach that he found in Story of the Latter-day Saints, even though its authors thought it was faith-promoting, he saw it as critical. And one of the phrases he seized on was calling the early Christianity the primitive church. And he thought that was an insult to the church and did not recognize that that was a standard term out of biblical studies and religious studies for the first century or even earlier than that, the first years of Christianity, to call it the primitive church. And he thought that was meaning, you know, you call primitive people those who are the lesser people. So that was one thing. He objected to the way the first vision was handled. He objected to the term communistic being used to describe the United Orders. And apparently he'd forgotten that that term was also in the official comprehensive history of the church by B.H. Roberts that was published by the church itself as the publisher, whereas the Story of the Latter-day Saints was Deseret Book as the publisher. But because of these objections, he wrote a letter shortly after the book was published, and he said there will be no second printing. This got back to Leonard fairly quickly. Leonard was just crestfallen and terribly upset and didn't know how to heal. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, I've been authorized to do this, but it's another thing when the first presidency obviously didn't approve every word that appeared in that book. And so it became a matter of perception. And the perception on the part of Ezra Taft Benson, Marquis Peterson, and Boyd K. Packer in particular, three apostles, varying from senior to a junior apostle, was their perception was that Leonard was, whether he intended to or not, he was doing a disservice to the church. And that's how they regarded him and his work and everyone who worked with him and everyone who expressed a point of view that he expressed. And that included little research assistants like me. And speaking of which, I was the first one he hired outside the current employees of the historical department. I was also the one who had the shortest tenure. I was the first to leave. I was only with Leonard for 18 months. And so I was first hired, and then going to Yale, I was the first to leave his history division, is what it was called.
Michael, in your study of church history, have you come across anything in the teachings in the Joseph Smith period regarding anything to do touching on homosexuality or same-sex marriage? And is there anything that you've seen in your study of the history or doctrine that lead you to believe that the church could someday make a change on their policies in regards to same-sex marriage?
Well, everything I have ever found in that time period of Joseph Smith, I put in the book Same-Sex Dynamics. And I adamantly disagree with a gay author, Mormon background, who wrote a book called Out of the Bishop's Closet. And in that book, Tony Felice claimed that he had seen documents that were hidden away in the church historian's office, which referred to a male-male sealing that was romantic. It was similar to a marital sealing. I have had, for my time, exceptional access to the documents of the historical department. I never saw anything like that. In the Journal of Discourses, Brigham Young did refer, and others referred, to sealing men to men. And if you don't know what they were referring to, you could think that that was a marital sealing. But he was referring to adoption, which was sealing usually a married man with his family and his children to an apostle as an adoption ceremony so that this elder or high priest would be sealed to an apostle instead of to his own living father. And this was a part of this hierarchy of priesthood office that became important with polygamy. Well, it was also important in the sealing ordinance. And it was more often called the law of adoption. And that was practiced. But there was no romantic, no marital dimension to it whatsoever. Now, Joseph Smith did have very close associations with male friends. He had closer associations with females. And he was clearly, by our definitions, heterosexual. But he enjoyed the company of other men. He had close friendships. And one time, and I quote this in the book, he was out with a young man out hunting most of the day. And when the young man came back, he was being criticized for the hours that he had spent away from home. And Joseph said, "Oh, don't criticize him. We're married." Well, this is the way Joseph Smith regarded relationships, that they were intensely bonded. And in fact, the last night of Joseph Smith's life, he was not with Emma. He was in the arms of a Welch member of the church, Dan Jones. And they shared the floor of the Carthage jail and fell asleep in each other's arms. And he gave a sermon about a year and a half before that, where he talked about how the common practice of male friends sleeping together, speaking together, sharing, in his view, the words of the gospel in the embrace of friendship, and waking up in that embrace. And he used that common practice as an analog or a symbol for the resurrection. But despite that intensity of friendship, I have no evidence that he ever condoned same-sex relations. And there was an accusation, even during his lifetime, of sodomy against one of the Higbee brothers, who had been a lieutenant, I think, maybe higher than a lieutenant, might have been a colonel, in the Nauvoo Legion under Joseph Smith's direction. And the Higbees were better known for associating with women who are not their wives, but the church political newspaper, The Wasp, which was edited by Joseph Smith's brother, William, an apostle, made the accusation that Chauncey Higbee was also guilty of sodomy. The interesting thing is that the one thing Joseph did say about sodomy was a redefinition of what the crime of Sodom was. The traditional Protestant definition, which had been generations in print, preached over the pulpit, was that it was sexual sin. And Joseph Smith said it was ingratitude, that they were inhospitable to the angels, and that was the sin of Sodom, which was very, very different from every printed, spoken definition that Protestant and Catholic, but Joseph Smith was more influenced by Protestant theology and sermons. Other than that, he didn't comment about sodomy. It didn't come up as a area of condemnation. He did comment on the sermon in terms of the sin of Sodom, and in doing that, he separated that and the punishment of Sodom from sexual behavior.
There's a lot of current interest right now in the subject of polygamy. And the church has distanced itself from earlier positions. And I just wonder if, of course, we know that we have apostles who are married to more than one woman, and I presume sealed to both of them. So would you want to comment on the history of polygamy and how that relates to the current position as you see it?
Regarding polygamy. The church leadership has been embarrassed about polygamy ever since the 1920s. Up until the presidency of Heber J. Grant, the first presidency did two things. They, in their statements and over the pulpit, whether it was Wilfred Woodruff or Lorenzo Snell or Joseph F. Smith, they said this is a divine principle. It was commanded. The only reason we lived it was because God commanded it. We've given it up because God authorized us to, or in some cases they said commanded us to. But it is a true principle, and I will say it's true until the day I die. That was the position of those three presidents after the Manifesto of 1890, which was advice of the president of the church for members to live the law, laws of the land concerning marriage. Things changed when Heber J. Grant became president, and he was the last polygamist to become president, although both of his other wives, he was married to three women, and his first wife and his second wife preceded him in death. So when he became president of the church, he was legally married to Augusta, who had previously been a plural wife, but was now at his becoming president, his legal wife. And at that same time, the quiet practice of post-manifesto polygamy, which had been going on for 14 years with the approval of the leadership of the church for the most part, first presidency approval for the most part, there continued to be those who were performing plural marriages without claiming the authority of the leadership of the church to do so. They claimed a separate line of authority. Even though Joseph F. Smith had authorized excommunication in 1910 for such people who were continuing to enter into plural marriage, he was not as personally furious about the practice, the continued practice, as was Heber J. Grant. Heber J. Grant was just livid. Any time he learned about a new plural marriage, and some of his closest associates were marrying plural wives in 1909 onward, men that he had known and loved for years, and he felt betrayed. And then some of the advocates of plural marriage were claiming that he had married a plural wife after the manifesto, which he had wanted to do, and he even admitted to non-Mormons that he'd wanted to do that. But he hadn't. And the fact that these stories were being circulated as knowing winks and nods by people like Lauren Woolley infuriated Heber J. Grant to the point that the church's position moved from being simply denial of the right to practice plural marriage and punishment ecclesiastically to active cooperation with law enforcement to bring about the punishment of those members of the church who had been excommunicated for living plural marriage and in some cases had moved to what was then called Short Creek, Arizona, more recently renamed Colorado City, although it's been Colorado City for about 50 years. But it was traditionally known as Short Creek, Arizona, as a outpost, a God-forsaken outpost. Just the people who went there they wanted to go where no one else wanted. I mean, Brigham Young, they wanted the top Brigham Young. And it was a struggle for them. But they went there to live plural marriage. Most of them had been excommunicated, not all of them. They circulated these stories of authorized plural marriage that had occurred for 14 years and in a few cases beyond the manifesto, 17 years beyond the manifesto, 18 in one case. But those authorized exceptions were overlapping with new plural marriages that Joseph F. Smith, for example, was not authorizing. It was a very confusing set of circumstances for members of the church to figure out because you had authorized plural marriages occurring at the same time. Clearly unauthorized plural marriages were occurring. And the position of the first presidency was to not deny that there were any of these plural marriages. And that, of course, created a gap of confidence, a gap of credibility, because many people could point to children born in marriages that had been performed by apostles up to 1904 and 05, by others after that with presidency approval. And the fact that these were coexisting with marriages performed by patriarchs on their own authority was beside the point from the point of view of the first presidency, but was an argument to continue plural marriage no matter what the first presidency said on the part of those who wanted to live the old-time religion. Well, whereas Joseph F. Smith made exceptions, a handful of exceptions after the so-called Second Manifesto that he issued in April 1904, Heber J. Grant was adamantly opposed. And it became a personal issue for him, and he attacked over the pulpit those who were continuing to live it, and they attacked him in print and made all kinds of accusations against him. And that animosity that developed in the 1920s set the stage for the kind of attitude that the members of the general authorities whose names we recognize and who lived during the time that we were alive, this was the kind of conflict that they were young men in and becoming adults in and entering church leadership in. And they became almost to a man adamantly hostile to polygamy. And from their point of view, it was counterproductive to praise polygamy as a divine revelation and then to comment about these disgusting polygamists today. And so they just commented about these disgusting polygamists and stopped saying that polygamy was a divine institution. And they referred to the Section 132 as little as they could, because they did not want people being attracted to the practice of polygamy. But, you know, that was kind of impossible. The church heritage, the family heritage of so many thousands, tens of thousands, by now I think hundreds of thousands of Mormons, is that heritage is interlinked with polygamy in the past. And so you have to mentally turn against your ancestors if you're going to maintain the kind of wholesale condemnation that most Mormons feel now for polygamy. And it's gone beyond the leadership. I think most Mormons feel nothing but revulsion for plural marriage today. But it had its origins, that feeling of revulsion had its origins in the 1920s with that conflict between Heber J. Grant and those who were continuing to promote plural marriage.
Can you say any more with reference to right now, today, with, say, President Monson or President Hinckley, in terms of their attitude? Can you discern that? Or do you think it's pretty much what you've said?
Well, the general authority, the highest general authority that I had the closest relationship with, was Spencer W. Kimball, who, as I pointed out, had a toward historical plural marriage, he had this combination of reverence, ancestor veneration, and humor. But his wife was the daughter of a post-manifesto polygamist. And so he also was aware of the exceptions that were made. I'm not so sure that President Benson after him, President Hunter, President Hinckley, although I laid this out for President Hinckley in his private study during an interview, so he knew from me details. But I doubt that Thomas S. Monson is aware of this overlapping, this subterranean period of when polygamy was being both denied and authorized. And so I think the leaders today generally think that the manifesto was an ironclad document. And unless they have a family connection going back to that 250 marriages that were performed with church authority from 1890 to 1904, clearly church authority, then I, you know, unless they have a family connection, I think that pretty much they see it as a you know, the wall came down in 1890, and anyone after that point was misguided. Maybe faithful, maybe well-intentioned, but misguided. And they would put Apostles Cowley and Taylor in that camp of misguided but well-intentioned people, and they were released, and the church made a clean break by that public release. The actual story was far more complex, painful, contradictory, and I doubt that very few of, or very many of the general authorities are aware of that at all. In my interview with, and other interviews that I've read that Spencer W. Kimball had, he freely acknowledged the practice of plural marriage after the manifesto. He would refer to his father-in-law as being one of those who entered plural marriage, although his wife was from the first wife, not the plural wife. When I say his, Spencer Kimball's wife, Camilla, he referred to his aunts who became plural wives of prominent stake presidents and mission presidents after the manifesto. He was very open about this, but he had a personal connection to it. And I think most of the leadership of the church does not today. Some, and in my extensions of power, I trace down interrelationships that the leaders in 1996 had with one another. A number of those general authorities in 1996 had post-manifesto ancestors. In some cases, the polygamous wives, in most cases, a man who had married a polygamous wife after the manifesto, but the general authority himself or his wife herself was descended through the first marriage, but not in all cases. So if those who have the family connection, they know that things are not as publicly stated. Those who don't have that connection, I think, honestly, are not aware.
Cool. So would you guys please join me in giving Michael a warm applause and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints. No toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far to drive, do this and your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well, all is well. Why should we mourn? I think our love is hard. 'Tis not so. should we die before our journey's through? Happy day.